Senate Committee on Labor, March 29, 1989, 3 p.m., Hearing Room C. Informational meeting, SB 1051. Invited testimony only. Public hearing and possible work session, SB 553. Public hearing and possible work session.
The Senate Labor Committee to order. We have a couple of special orders of business before we get to the public hearing on Senate Bill 553, but it should take only a couple of minutes, so if you'll bear with us. First, we've posted Senate Bill 1051 as a method or opportunity to visit with a particular issue when it comes to the relationship between the Legislative Assembly and the Executive Branch. And I call on Senator Hill. You had some remarks about the
Mr. Chairman, the issue that's before the committee for this discussion is the issue of how we deal with migrant and seasonal farm workers in our employment division, our state employment division. Under federal regulations, states are required to do certain things and provide certain services. Included in the list of requirements is a position at the state level and then field office positions that are called migrant and seasonal farm worker monitor advocates. The purpose of those positions includes to advocate for migrant and seasonal farm workers who receive services from the state employment division. This is required by federal law, as I said, and Oregon has such a position. There has been criticism of the department for several years.
The division, excuse me.
For several years from various sectors of various organizations that the state hasn't done a good job. And in fact, in 1987, the Oregon Employment Division was found to be out of compliance with the federal requirements by the Department of Labor. That found that, among other deficiencies, the position was vacant. It was not filled, and we were not meeting federal requirements. This brought our federal funding, or some of our federal funding, in the Employment Division into jeopardy, and also put us up for various sanctions if the deficiencies weren't remedied. And of course, those services were not being delivered to the migrant and seasonal farm workers that they should have been. Since then, there's been, I believe, three different individuals who've occupied the position of migrant and seasonal farm workers monitor advocate. The most recent occupant of the position has just been removed from the position. Last fall, I sent a letter to the Employment Division, to Mr. Hunter, who's here today, asking about the program in the Employment Division and what the agency's policies were and the intent of the agency, and received a reply. The agency intended to meet the requirements of the law. I have a concern, which I share with other organizations, that we are not yet complying with federal regulations and federal statutes. So we, especially with the most recent transfer of the individual who was performing as monitor advocate. So as of now, I understand the position is vacant. It was vacant for 5 months last summer. It was vacant for the summer before that. And of course, along with the vacancy, there's concern that the other parts of the mission are not being delivered. I'd like to ask up for the purposes of the background information for the committee a couple of folks, Eunice Getz and Michael Dale. Eunice Getz representing the Hispanic Commission and Michael Dale representing Oregon Legal Services, to share with the committee their organization's observations about this particular mission in the Employment Division.
Okay, if Ms. Getz and Mr. Dale will come up, I ask you to. As you heard when I announced the special order, we're going to keep it as brief as possible and ask you to zero directly into the point.
Okay. Me first.
Whomever.
Okay. I'm Eunice Getz, the Executive Director of the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. One of the purposes for the Commission is to monitor the needs of the Hispanic community and make recommendations to the governor and the legislature and state agencies. In October of 1987, I attended a regional monitor advocate conference in Kennewick, Washington, At that conference, I became aware of the extensive nature of the advocate program that is intended by the Employment Training Administration of the Department of Labor. At that conference, I was shocked and embarrassed by the Monitor Advocate program represented by Oregon. The Commission has since continued monitoring the Monitor Advocate program. We have made the following observations. Both the federal regulations of the Employment Training Administration and the community-based organizations, including farm worker organizations, have the expectation that the Monitor Advocate should be independent and report or have direct access to the director of the division. In this way, the Monitor Advocate will be able to implement the program properly. This includes the ability to audit the Advocate program, report the findings directly to the director with the expectation that the director will then respond appropriately to bring the program into compliance with the employment and training regulations. The Commission has not been able to determine that this is the case in Oregon. Last May, when the Monitor Advocate left the position, it was not filled until October, leaving the position vacant for several months. When the Monitor Advocate attempts to fulfill the obligation of the regulations and the expectations of the community, the result seems to be irresponsible and vindictive behavior that then punishes the Monitor Advocate. When the Commission wrote to the director inquiring about the implementation of the Monitor Advocate program, the Commission was informed that the Monitor Advocate was simply a technical job. The Monitor Advocate position remains buried under four layers of administration. Two successive Monitor Advocates have been dismissed for unclear reasons. The Commission feels that the actions of the Employment Division has been to the detriment of the professional careers of two conscientious individuals. Further, the inaction of the division to properly implement the program has led to the fact that hundreds and probably thousands of migrant farm workers have been denied services. The Commission feels that this is unconscionable, particularly during last fall and winter when the Monitor Advocate program should have had a major part in helping the influx of migrant farm workers and their needs. This was a time also when great pressure was being put on the governor and the state and finally the emergency board for services. The Commission feels that the division was a detriment to the governor and the state as a result.
Okay. Mr. Dale.
My name is Michael Dale. I'm with the Farm Worker Program of Oregon Legal Services. We have had a concern for a number of years that the Migrant and Seasonal Farm Worker Program of the Employment Service has not provided adequate services for migrant and seasonal farm workers. However, in years past, it was less of a concern because the Employment Service was so tangential or so little a part of the way that farm workers actually found jobs that the inadequacies of these services were not of as great a concern. However, with the changing labor market situation, whether you're talking about recruiting the available legalized or legal U.S. workers who are in the United States available for work in agriculture, or whether you're talking about bringing in H-2A temporary workers from another country to work in agriculture, the employment service system plays a vital role in the filling of these jobs. And with that change, it seems that it is imperative that the state's employment service provide adequate services in this area. Now, Mr. Hunter's made a number of commitments in a variety of forums in an attempt to move ahead in this area, and we're pleased with those efforts. We remain concerned that a key component of an effective system is a Monitor Advocate that operates independently and with the apparent authority and support of the highest levels of the division. There is a sense in which the role of the Monitor Advocate is at odds with the bureaucratic imperative of the line manager of a branch office. And if there isn't support from above, the ability of the Monitor Advocate to affect the necessary changes in the way that business is done in the employment service is going to be very, very minimal. I would look to the Employment Division at this point consistent with the efforts that they have begun to try to improve services to promptly fill the monetary advocate position, fill it with the kind of person that the federal regulations require, and through the kinds of process that those regs require, do that expeditiously, and then position the monitor advocate in the kind of role envisioned by federal requirements and really, as a practical matter, mandated by the kind of job you're expecting that person to do, so that we can move ahead with an effective farm labor recruitment system and not be caught with an inadequate system that breaks down and leaves Oregon's agriculture and Oregon's agricultural workers high and dry.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Appreciate that. Mr. Hunter, Ms. Eldridge, one or both? Can you respond briefly? Before you start, that the chair wants to alert you and others in the audience that I want to get an overview, and then I plan on appointing a special subcommittee to further explore this. We don't have time today, and it's not an issue that I want to let go of. So if you can respond briefly and succinctly and give us some information about the monitor advocate, and how many we've had, how many months we've been without one, the testimony that you've heard, the comments of Senator Hill, what response you would make.
Chairman Kearns, members of the Senate Labor Committee, I'm Bill Hunter, administrator of the State Employment Security Agency, the Employment Division. I appreciate the opportunity to have been asked by this committee to come before you to talk about this very important issue. I applaud the chairman's comments of appointing a task force or a committee to look into this situation, because I think it will put to rest once and for all what in fact is indeed happening in the division in reference to its monitor advocate program. Then I think this legislative body of the state and all of the citizens of the state will have an opportunity to have heard or listened to objective facts, and whether or not the division proves to be doing its job, at least it will be proven instead of condemnation by innuendos and allegations. I applaud again the chairman's decision to do that, and I would also like to point out to the chair and members of the committee that we have been in contact with the Department of Labor. We have asked the Department of Labor to come down to the state and do an investigation of our Monitor Advocates program, so that this state, this legislative body, and all of its citizens will have a third-party, completely objective look-see at our Monitor Advocate position. If the look-see proves that our advocate program is as ineffective and as inefficient as people are claiming, then I think this body has a reason to be concerned. If the investigation prove, however, that the program is in fact light years from where it was before and it is basically a solid program, I do trust that it would put to rest once and for all the allegations that our program is not serving the citizens of the state. With me today is Ms. Beth Eldridge, who happens to be our Assistant Administrator for Field Operations, in whose area of responsibility the Monitor Advocate Program comes. Beth will be glad to address the specifics of our program in its overview.
Thank you, Bill. Senator Kearns, committee members, I also appreciate the opportunity to come to talk to you about your concerns about this program, because I've been hearing for several days that there has been a connection made between a recent personnel action we took and the degree to which our programs are going to be carried out. And I'd like to make a few points here to alleviate the concerns that there's a connection between those two things. The agency has taken several positive steps in the last 12 months, and I think that they're evidence of a fairly massive response to the concerns that have arisen.
Could I interrupt?
Excuse me, Senator
Schumer. I know nothing about the Monitor Advocate Program. Could you start from the beginning and tell me what it is and what it's supposed to do, what you have been doing, and what the problems are? Assume that I know nothing, because that is a safe assumption.
Chairman Karen, Senator Schumacher, certainly I'd be happy to. The positions that we have in the Employment Division that are related to migrant activities are funded out of the same Wagner-Peiser monies that fund our basic labor exchange that exists statewide. Federal regulations require specific services to migrant seasonal farm workers, and they require us to have a central office position, which is the monitor advocate position, to coordinate and review those activities and our services to migrants. The primary thrust of the program, if I can summarize it real briefly, arose from a concern that migrants were not being given the full range of services on the employment service side that non-migrants were being given. So the primary function of the migrant outreach workers in the field is to seek out migrants and seasonal farm workers who would not necessarily be coming into our office for services and make sure that the full range of services above and beyond agricultural work, we're talking full range of all kinds of jobs and services are available to those migrants. The Employment Division has expanded their program beyond what's required by the federal regulations so that in addition to the monitor advocate position and three migrant outreach workers who are stationed in significant offices, and the Department of Labor defines significant as where the total, that 10% or more of the applicants we have registered in the offices are migrants. Three of our offices fit that definition. In addition to that, we've recently added four additional offices where we believe there is high migrant activity, even though they're not showing up.
So you got seven field offices?
So we have seven that have migrant outreach workers. We also have an additional 14 what we call agricultural reps who are now becoming a lot more involved in migrant outreach to make sure that the employer needs and the migrant needs and the farm worker needs are all merging so that we can solve the problems as a group instead of as adversaries.
And what do these people do? The seven, they are field offices, I take it. They're outside of the Salem office. They're out in Yamhill County and Marion County and other counties.
That's
correct. What do they do?
The migrant outreach workers do a variety of things. They actually go out into the communities, into migrant communities, make sure that the migrants are aware of our services, encourage them to come into the local office. If they don't wish to come into the local office, they assist them in the application procedures wherever they are. And they also make sure that the migrants and the farm workers are available of other community services that are there to do other, you know, social services related kinds of activities with them.
Are these people usually of the same racial background as the migrant workers and speak the language?
Yes, the migrant outreach workers are bilingual, bicultural, and they are, the regs actually require them to be one of three things. One is bilingual, the other is of a migrant background, and the other is that they are racially or ethnically of the same, similar to the majority of the migrants in the area. In Oregon's case, it's primarily Hispanic. So they are Hispanic, bilingual, and of a migrant background.
So they're out there then working with the migrants, speaking their language, helping them understand how the system works here, what's available to them, what other jobs might be available to them, answer some of their specific problems they're having at their job or their camp or with their farm labor contractor, all those kinds of problems. They're sort of the ombudsman, right?
That's correct.
Have there been complaints that it hasn't been working well? Apparently there has.
The 1987 Federal Review identified a number of deficiencies. It also made a number of recommendations, and it had one violation of federal regulations. In the past 12 months, all of those deficiencies have been corrected. The violation has been corrected, and the recommendations have all been implemented. As Mr. Hunter said earlier, we had requested that the Region 10 Office of Department of Labor come down immediately to do another review, and they have scheduled that for the beginning of April.
So they are, in fact, coming down.
They are coming down.
Do you feel that the complaints and the violation were essentially well-founded? In other words, there was room for improvement, or do you think it was an overreaction on the part of the Fed's part?
Senator Schumacher, I was not at the Employment Division when that review took place, but certainly reviewing the federal regulations, I think the requirements are all appropriate, and if they found deficiencies, then it was imperative that they be corrected. I think that the steps that we've taken to correct the deficiencies were just the first portion of a, as I said earlier, a fairly massive response to a number of IRCA-related activities that we, the recommendations were formulated in the process of our participating in the Governor's IRCA Coordinating Committee and more recently in the new Agricultural Labor Commission. We've also recently appointed an advisory board specifically to the Employment Division to advise us on migrant and agricultural issues so that we are not simply responding to federal regulations and reviews but to the immediate situation in Oregon.
You've got how many full-time equivalent people then that are working on this program?
Well, specifically on migrant and agricultural related issues, we have approximately 23. That's not counting myself, Mr. Hunter, Diana Clamp, who's the ES program manager, and a lot of other staff people who are working on all of the recommendations related to IRCA.
23 people. I'm almost through with this. It's all right. Do you feel that you are sufficiently staffed to do the job that you've been assigned?
Senator Schumacher.
Shoemaker, by the way.
Shoemaker, I'm sorry. No, I don't think the Employment Division or any one of its programs is sufficiently staffed. I think there's always more that we could do.
Are you overwhelmed? Or is it just like everybody else, you don't really have, you're pushed to your limit and you could do with more, but?
I often feel overwhelmed. I think in general, it's difficult to say because the magnitude of the problem has not currently been defined. There's a lot of speculation as to what the labor needs and labor supply is going to be this season. I recently received some word from the region that indicated that the Immigration Service is not going to be reviewing agricultural employers to the degree that they originally thought they were this season, which DOL is interpreting as somewhat taking the heat off of the problem this season. It's hard for me to tell if that's true. I think that in terms of outreach to find sufficient numbers of legal workers to supply the employers with what they need, we have our fingers crossed as to whether our resources are sufficient.
Okay, so that's, I think, all I need to ask now. Thank you very much, and thanks for your patience, Mr. Chairman.
Quite all right. I want to interject and remind the members that we are 40 minutes into the hour on a day in which we posted 5:53 for a full dress hearing. So with that in mind, Senator Hill.
Mr. Chairman, just to the committee, I think in the task force or the subcommittee that you're going to appoint, we'll have a chance to look at the federal regulations, to examine the history of the monitor advocate services provided by the Employment Division over the past several years, and to also look at the personnel files of the last three monitor advocates and determine if indeed they were allowed to do their job or if they were denied the opportunity to do their job, and that their attempts to perform consistent with federal regulations, in fact, contributed to their being discharged from the position. I've been following the issue for a number of months now, and I think that the DOL should make a full audit of the performance of the agency, and I've also requested them to come down and do a full audit over the next few weeks, however long it takes the DOL to move. But just to raise an issue, and the reason why I'm concerned, Senator, the last monitor advocate, it's irrelevant as to who he is at this point or who he where he is now, but he was serving for a number of months and got satisfactory reviews overall for his performance. In fact, he was congratulated on a couple occasions for his performance in office. He made a significant report to the executive team at the Employment Division criticizing the agency and suggesting ways forward, and I think that's a fair characterization of his report. He pointed out areas that needed improvement and areas that needed to be moved forward. And the next day, he was transferred out of the position. This was May 20th of last year. The position remained vacant through the whole summer. In the fall, I wrote a letter to Bill and asked, is this position vacant? And he wrote me back, Bill, and I have a copy of your letter, and you said, no, the position was not vacant until September 5th. Now, in fact, the position had been vacant from May 20th, yet you told me it was not vacant. In fact, during the entire summer, we were out of compliance with the law, and that's the exact violation that we were cited for in 1987. The violation was we didn't have a monitor advocate. And here we were again the following year, well, 5 months without the monitor advocate, and when I ask, I'm told that that wasn't the case.
Let me jump
so
right
these
in.
These are some of the reasons I have concerns.
Let me jump in and ask as a point of information, if you wish to respond to that statement before we move this item off our agenda.
Senator Karen, I would definitely appreciate the opportunity to respond. Senator Hill is, of course, correct when he said his comments about the report that was submitted by the then monitor advocate making certain recommendations and pointing out certain deficiencies in our program was in fact a fair characterization. What was, however, an inaccurate juxtaposition of the two is that the then monitor advocate was transferred because of that report. That is an unfair characterization. My letter to the senator informing him that that position was not vacant was in fact a letter, to my knowledge, true to the conditions existing. When the two witnesses before came before this committee to testify, both of which, it might not have been the witnesses, maybe it was Senator Hill, I'm not too sure which, but someone characterized the position as being vacant through the summer. I then leaned over and checked with Ms. Eldridge to ask her, was that a true statement? She said, no, the position was not, in fact, vacant during the summer. As a matter of fact, the position is not vacant now. So those are two bits of inaccurate information that has been entered into the record, and we would like to clear up.
Ms. Turner, I appreciate your responding to that. I'm going to appoint Senators Hill, Senator Shoemaker and Senator Houck as a subcommittee to take this matter up and have Senator Hill chair that. I ask the members of that subcommittee to take their time, that is to say both in scheduling and in a report back to the committee, and to not meet precipitously. In fact, if they can meet once, it would be, I think, in the interest of all of the members. If they have to meet twice, that would be fine. If they could meet after a DOL report was made that might illuminate the problems, that would be worthwhile and might in fact prevent, you know, keep us from having to plow the same ground twice. But I leave that up to your discretion. I'd appreciate it if you would supply to the members of that subcommittee copies of the federal laws and regulations and the administrative rules and other memoranda governing that position at the state level, and anything else that they might need for information to educate themselves prior to them coming back together as a subcommittee. Be able to do that.
Mr. Chair, we will, of course, do that. Just two very quick comments. Again, we appreciate this opportunity because what we have had to deal with thus far are individuals who have made explicit, almost on top of the rock kind of allegations against the operation of the Employment Division. But the interesting thing about it, that none of those individuals have bothered to come inside of the Employment Division to find out exactly what is going on. So your subcommittee gives us an excellent opportunity. The second point I would like to make is we would make to this committee the same offer we made to Senator Hill. The allegation was made that the MFSW has been transferred because of some advocacy. We told Senator Hill at the time that our decision rise and fall on the records we have. We sent a list of those records asking the senator to choose from any one or all he wanted. We would gladly make those records available to him. We would do the same thing for this committee, so the committee would at least have both sides of the coin and then make a decision. We appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. So I will appoint that subcommittee.
And Mr. Chair, before we conclude, I would like to specifically request a transcript of this part of the hearing.
Yes, I think that would be a verbatim transcript in order to illuminate the issues. Okay, that subcommittee is appointed. The chair has one other item. If there is no objection from the committee, the chair would order counsel to draw three subpoenas for the purposes of calling the three previous occupants of the minority advocate position before that subcommittee. I'm doing that not by virtue of the fact that I think they would not appear, but by virtue of the fact that they really ought to be brought forward at the request of the committee so that their continued state service might not be affected. We're not asking them to come up and volunteer. We're ordering them to appear. Is there objection to that order to counsel? Hearing.
In our opinion, in our experience, that is a real possible difference. But that's not a difference that gets to the fundamental issue of union representation. That more gets to the issue of allowances in the contract or in a contract negotiation by saying and setting up a formula whereby steady workers may have the option of having additional benefits rather than extra increase in wages, and different for seasonal workers. That would be more in the neighborhood of job classifications, and that's something I think that's commonly done all the time. But I think, as Cipriano mentioned earlier, we find that many steady workers have their grievances and could have those grievances addressed. One substantial grievance that exists for steady workers is unjust termination. You could have a guy working on a ranch for 10 years, and tomorrow the grower may go out and say, well, I don't want you working here anymore. Unjust termination. That affects him much more devastatingly than it may for a worker who's been on the job for a week. It may be no less an injustice, but it may be perceived differently. So union representation could be useful for that worker but and for the...
I can see why the steady worker, permanent worker, could very well decide to have union representation. But I can also see that the reasons which would impel the seasonal workers to do so might not apply to the steady worker. And that, I guess I'm wondering if the two shouldn't be able to decide independent of each other whether or not
Let me interject that we should flag this issue. It's really the definition of the bargaining unit. Mm-hmm. Who should be included in a particular bargaining unit, who should be excluded and either not be in it at all or be in a different one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a real good question and a legitimate question we should explore. Can we
move on?
We've described the issue and we should explore it more, and Annette is making a note of that particular issue, so we won't leave it behind.
Fine.
And as we continue to uncover issues, we'll flag them and put them on our list.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
As a footnote to that, if I may, Senator Shoemaker, one of the special accommodations in the process that we are proposing in this bill would create what's called a wall-to-wall bargaining unit. And I think that maybe bears further scrutiny with the comment you've made. But the reasoning behind that was to maximize, and I'll mention this later, maximize the simplicity of the elections, because elections are required in a prompt fashion in order not to have to get into issues of who's in which side, who's in which bargaining unit, and so on. Now, that's a balancing test again, and I think we may have to come back to that. But if I may then proceed with walking through the...
Thanks. Sorry for the digression.
No problem.
No, that was an excellent discussion. I'm not intending to discourage the committee from raising these questions, but we need to
move along.
To pace ourselves.
So we're in the situation where we've determined that more than, again, just under the formula we have presently, the bill, more than 50% of the workers are on the job, that a substantial showing among their number, whatever that may be, wants union representation or wants to raise the issue of that, then a petition is filed. That's day one. Under our bill, including the amendments we've proposed, the petitions filed with the Employment Relations Board, and they would immediately notify the employer and any other interested party required to be notified. Now, by day four, the employer would be obligated to produce for the board a roster of employees. And that simply consists of all of the workers on the payroll, on the previous, the payroll that falls previous to the date of the petition filing. So just take in your last payroll. Here it is. Here are all the workers. Now, that may be supplemented by any economic strikers that the board may find to be eligible. But our overall approach is to err on the side of including everybody who has, who claims an interest to vote, and sorting out challenges later. So we have, in effect, an inverted process from the existing process, where you sort out all the issues of bargaining unit eligibility and so on first, and then have your election. And I think the reason for that will become clear.
Okay, why don't you give us that reason?
Okay, the reason for that is precisely the changeability of the workforce. If we're to hold an election, say, on day one, or have file a petition on day one, and it takes 2 or 3 or 4 months to decide all these necessary issues before the election's held, and we end up in the month of November, December, those people aren't going to be there anymore. And we're not going to be able to ensure that the, you know, that a substantial portion of the workers who are affected by this issue are there to be consulted. So this would invert that process and say, let's have the election promptly, let's preserve all issues so that every side has its due process rights honored, and then sort them out after the fact in the hearing, so that we don't have to be in a position where we, you know, regardless of the outcome, where we don't have to go back and rerun that election, because that may be a practical impossibility. And that is very different than, say, public employment or many sectors of private employment, where there isn't that kind of turnover in the labor force, and you could reasonably go back 3 or 4 months later and have an election with approximately the same people still there. So the fourth day, the employer turns over the list. Now, at that same time, the employer has to make any objection to the geographic scope of the bargaining unit, so that everybody who might well be included or should be included is included in the voting, regardless of whatever challenges may be lodged against that. So if the employer says, I have a unit in Washington County, I have another unit in Marion County, I want them both included, even though our bill would say those would be treated normally as separate bargaining units because they're geographically disparate, the employer could say, no, I want those included, and the election would be held on the two sites and the results preserved. Even if we, for example, as a union might say, well, we don't think that's a good idea, we want to interpose an objection. On day five, from the date of the petition, any other union that seeks to intervene and also be put on the ballot must do so, must produce the appropriate showing of interest that they may have among the workforce, which we define as 20%. And the reason we give it the board at least 48 hours before the election so they have time to print the ballots, otherwise it would be too short of a window for them. On day seven, again under the bill as with the amendments we propose, the election would be held. And that's a mandatory provision in the statute. Now, in the case of a strike, if there's a strike at the time the petition's filed, the board would be mandated to do whatever possible to hold that election within 48 hours. Again, so the issue can be promptly resolved and everybody can get back to work, and there's no a minimal loss of production. Now, by day 12, any party following the election who has an objection has to make that objection known to the board, and then the board, by day 27, or 15 days hence, has to hold a hearing. Now, the importance of holding a prompt hearing has to do with witnesses, we believe, because if there are witnesses, let's say there's an objection to the conduct of the election, and there are witnesses who may be relevant to, may have relevant information, we want to make sure that those witnesses are available and that the hearings are held at such a time that they're no longer available in the area, and thus mooting the issue or making it difficult to make a fair determination. So there's three principles involved here in this timing, and we know it's an extraordinary time frame that we're talking about, but we think it's warranted because, number one, we want to ensure everybody's opportunity to be heard and to contest whatever issues they feel are relevant. But secondly, we want to maximize substantial worker participation in voting. So make sure that when the election's run, it's run with every possible party included that could be voting, and sort out the challenges later. And thirdly,
Mr. Glenn, yes. Senator Shoemaker.
Yeah, I can see why you want it. I guess I'm a little concerned that on the other side, I mean, people may have legitimate reasons to either add to the process, subtract to the process, inject something into the process. If they don't know it, I mean, if they only have 1 day or 2 days to absorb all this and to think it through and to respond, is that fair to them? I mean, you need a little time to absorb information and react to it. 1 week from the time you notify that you're going to have an election until you have one and have to get all these things done, that seems to me to be kind of tight. I mean, surely these people are there more than a week.
Well, let me make 2 points about that, Senator Shoemaker. First of all, we're certainly open to modifying that if that really seems unreasonable under the circumstances. But, and we're not, in other words, 7 days, maybe it could be 8 days or 10 days. The important thing is promptly. And the other thing, the key, you know, the seven-day idea we didn't sort of pull out of thin air. Where we got that idea was from California law. And that is California law, and it's been California law for 14 years. And they have run in excess of 900 elections in the state of California, representation elections, within the 7 days as required, and I believe have found, and I'm not certainly the person to speak to this, but I believe it's correct to say that they have found that that does work effectively. It does balance all the all the interests, making sure that workers have some opportunity to understand what's at stake here, to not let this drag on so that the workers aren't available, to not disrupt the work that's in progress, presumably, and at the same time make sure that a correct decision is arrived at. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let me interject, if I may, for the edification of the members and the folks in the audience. We're going to hear this bill again on the 10th of April, and we're going to have a teleconference with a member of the California Agricultural Labor Board on that day, and be able to ask questions, hear from them, ask them how that system works, and be able to ask them questions. We pipe it right into the room, and actually we can all hear that conversation and have a two-way dialogue. And the second thing is we're going to have Mr. Ellis of the ERB return to the committee on this issue on the 10th of April and also be prepared to respond to questions we might have about how they would take up the duties envisioned for them under this bill.
Senator Cairns, it's our intention, if possible, to actually have the California individual here personally, if at all possible.
Fine.
So that would even be more...
be better. Okay.
Worse. But in any event, to have that person available.
Do you need to interrupt? Go ahead.
The third point that we see is paramount here is to minimize, as I mentioned, the need to rerun hearings and elections so that we preserve the facts, the events, and can sort out the legal issues and findings later. And we do appreciate that that's a departure to some extent from existing procedure, but we think under the circumstances that it is warranted and it's necessary. Let me make several other more general points about why we think this bill is needed. One of the things that a collective bargaining agreement would do is eliminate the middleman, the contractor. And I know this committee has heard a lot of testimony and has already considered bills, and it seems is perennially considering bills that deal with labor contractors. And we believe that one more avenue to get at that problem is that doesn't simply require the state going out and enforcing the laws that are on the books, is to promote a process that creates a direct collective bargaining agreement and eliminates the middleman. This bill would also provide a vehicle for what we call non-state enforcement of wages and working conditions. Another area where the state is continually burdened with and usually, in our estimation, ends up with inadequate funding to carry out the obligations in relation to the problem of working conditions and wage violations. If we have a collective bargaining agreement, we're going to make sure that its terms are honored. And we're going to do that through the courts and to enforce the contract or whatever. And we will not be expending state resources in doing so. And lastly, there are all of the collateral benefits of better wages and benefits for workers. All of the social costs that I know the emergency board had to deal with, although somewhat limitedly, last November, that are consistently with us. The long-term effects of poverty. This is one more avenue as a way to get a fair relationship, economic relationship between worker and employer, and try to address those problems at the source. One other technical point is that the board is widely perceived as a board that's set up only to deal with public sector employment, but it in fact has in place all the procedures, rules and so on, and has actually exercised on several occasions, although limitedly, the procedures for private employment. There are certain private employers not covered by the National Labor Relations Act that are covered by the State Act, and they have all those devices in place and thought out for how to do that in a general private sector setting.
Questions of the witness? Senator Shoemaker?
Yeah, probably a lot of these would come up later, but just so that I get a hold of the whole problem. So your unionizing, if I can use that word, occurs then farm by farm. It's not, I mean, each
employer
farmer,
employer, yes,
there's an election that applies to each farm.
Right.
Sometimes the same worker will be involved in more than one election in the same summer.
It certainly could happen.
I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And once the decision has been made to collectively bargain, then it's in effect until an election, a subsequent election might go the other way. Is that right?
Senator Shoemaker,
is that the way it works?
Where we would fit under the existing structure of the law, which says that once a representation election has been held, regardless of the result, no other election can be held for 12 months. Meaning if we lose the election, we can't go
months,
back
okay.
in there.
But then it would continue on year to year.
Yes.
Until another election is called and the vote would vote goes the other way.
Correct.
Is that
a decertification?
Is that the
right.
process?
That's,
I mean, it's the same process in reverse, the same notice, the same everything.
Exactly.
Just you go in that way, and if you want to come out, you come out that way.
Exactly. That's our intent. That's
and
our
it would be the seasonal workers who are on the farm at the time of each election who would make that determination.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Ms. Chairman?
Do you have a further question?
No, that's all.
Senator Houck, Senator Hill.
If you are collective bargaining unit by unit, farm unit by farm unit, and you are bargaining for wages and you decide to call a strike in the time that they're on that particular farm, the majority of them are only a week or 2 weeks, how are you going to do that on a farm by farm basis?
Well, first of all, we may not, maybe as a follow-up to Senator Shoemaker's question, I think is relevant to yours as well, Senator, we don't necessarily feel that there has to be farm-by-farm negotiations. There could be, for example, association negotiations, and this, in fact, has been done in California, where, for example, if the strawberry growers say, we'd like to negotiate an industry-wide agreement that will apply to all of our members, and you on behalf of labor, on behalf of all people covered or hired for that purpose, we would be more than interested in sitting down and having those discussions. So there's not, it doesn't mean we have to do it that way, but I don't think there's any, other than the duration of the work, I don't think there's any difference between calling a strike where collective bargaining negotiations break down in farm labor as opposed to any other work site.
Well, except only on a project, maybe. You know, they'll only be on that unit or the actual housing of the bargaining unit 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You don't have the latitude of saying our contract extends in July unless you take each one of those units and say that.
Senator Houck, I'm not sure I completely understand your question, but
the difficulty in doing it farm by farm is my concern. Your association or your bargaining unit that covers like the whole all agreements in the state would be a way to handle it, but I'm not so sure that's a practical way to handle it.
Well, we would be open, certainly, Senator Houck, to whatever. I mean, if that's a concern that the employer has or employers have, the timing of when a contract would end. How many, you know, whether it's specifically point farm by farm or whether it's crop by crop or county by county or whatever might be most suitable, we're more than willing to sit down and discuss that at the bargaining table. That's where I think the same kind of issues come up around public employment. When is the best time for a contract negotiation to occur, given that there's funding questions or whatever? And those same other different dynamics, but of a similar nature, I think, or similar type, rather, apply in agriculture, and we would simply say to them, okay, that's one of the issues, is when should the contract be up, and how wide should it be, and and so on. Those would be specific things that we would raise at the bargaining table.
Okay. Chair.
Senator Hill, Senator Shoemaker.
I'll defer my question. Okay, because I'm going to follow up on Senator Houck's question regarding industry-wide or association-wide votes. I just want to get a hold of how that might work. So you're within this bill, which I haven't really studied, it's possible then for an association of growers to call for an election.
No, it's not. Senator Shoemaker, the only way that election can be called is by a petition on behalf of employees. But let me make one other point, then. That is, existing law allows for what they call a consent election, where, for example, if we sit down tomorrow with the Strawberry Commission or the whatever Association of Growers, and an agreement is worked out, if this bill were in place, we could then petition for elections on whatever number of farms and have elections. Or we could even waive elections if there was an agreement already between employer and employee. But if there was workers who contested that, then said, no, that's not what we want here, those workers could petition and have an election and not certify the union and not adopt that contract in that particular setting. But as a practical matter, I think that if we were to conclude an industry-wide agreement or a crop-wide agreement or whatever, it would already have been with consultation with as many of the workers, our members or not, as we possibly could, because we certainly don't want to be in the position of agreeing to or defending a contract that the majority of the workers don't want.
Okay. So, in other words, the workers could decide whether to pursue an industry-wide agreement or a unit-by-unit agreement. That would be essentially your prerogative, which to pursue.
Okay. Right.
I'm going to follow up on that. You also said that kind of industry wide, like I think of in the joint bargaining agreements, like in wood products and some other industries, those are done by agreement of the parties to do that. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you say it could be done at the invitation of the association, in order to avoid the hassles and all the trouble and heartache and et cetera of a, you know, trench warfare, unit to unit, farm by farm, take it all in one lump, yes or no. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah,
they did. Both sides would have to agree to enter into those negotiations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Both would have attraction, that things that would attract them for different reasons.
Okay, then just to be sure I understand, if either side didn't want to do it industry-wide, it would be done unit by unit.
That's my understanding. But yeah, you can't
only
force...
Only if both sides thought under it's best to go as a block, then you do it.
That's my understanding of joint bargaining agreements in other trades, in other industries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Correct. Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
I hope you forgive these many naive questions that you're going to get.
Council will take a look.
Do.
Okay. Further questions of this witness? Mr. Farrell, were you called and why I had to go to another meeting? I'm back. If you testified, I missed it.
I did.
Okay. Other questions of these witnesses? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Going to call Janine Meyer Rodriguez, Steve Sokoch. I can see it's a representative from ASME, but I don't see the name. Do we have a ASME representative here to testify? If not, okay. Mr. Castagna, you want to join them then?
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janine Meyer Rodriguez, and I'm the political director of the Oregon Public Employees Union. Today, I have two hats. Alice Dale, who is the executive director of OPEU, could not make it. She's involved in intense negotiations with the state, so she was unable to get away. So I'd like to just make a few comments under my hat and then switch to Alice's. OPU supports this bill. Personally, I've always wondered why it is that farm workers, their needs and their rights throughout history have generally been ignored. As a graduate and as a student and a graduate of a labor relations school, I never understood why the National Labor Relations Act did not include farm workers under the collective bargaining rights. As I got involved in politics, I realized that migrant farm workers have no roots, they have no legislators generally because of their mobility, and they have no lobbyists. It's only through the union movement that migrant workers' needs have been addressed at all. Cesar Chavez took the issue to the public with his Great Boycott and heightened the awareness of the suffering of migrant workers and their children. Like people who receive public assistance, migrant families often continue to be migrant workers generation after generation due to the low wages and due to their inability to educate their children because of their constant mobility. The same is true in the area of representation and collective bargaining. Migrant mobility makes it difficult to organize under the current rules under the National Labor Relations Act. OPEU members working in social service agencies throughout Oregon also care about the plight of farm workers because due to the poor wages and the lack of health care and their migrant status are often forced to seek some level of public assistance, whether it be basic food or health care. So our workers deal with them. Giving farm workers the opportunity to exercise the same rights afforded to other workers in the area of collective bargaining and labor relations would serve us all in that it would promote self-determination over paternalism and install meaningful and true rights to collective bargaining. If there aren't any questions, I'll now be Alice Dale.
I read ahead. Would it be possible to have you submit that testimony see if there are questions?
Yes, I have submitted it.
Appreciate that. Okay. I would draw the attention of the committee to the middle paragraph of Ms. Dale's statement as one that's most revealing. Who's next? Mr. Sokotch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Sokotch, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, also appearing today on behalf of President Irv Fletcher, who is currently in Washington, D.C. on AFL-CIO business. We are a federation of over 300 local unions representing more than 80,000 working men and women in the state of Oregon. I'm here today to express the state federation's support for Senate Bill 553, which would extend the right to organize and bargain collectively with farm workers of our state. Students of labor history are aware that in the 1930s, Congress extended the right of collective bargaining to most workers in the United States. The Congress excluded farm workers. In 1973, the Oregon legislature extended collective bargaining privileges to its public employees and most of the other workers in the state who had been denied coverage under the federal act. The legislature excluded farm workers. During this last summer, it became clear to the Oregon AFL-CIO and many others that the exploitation of farm workers had in fact reached intolerable levels. Average farm worker income actually dropped by 50% or more, causing hundreds of farm workers and their families to live in their cars or crowd into barns or slum housing, which lacked even the most basic services, which many of us take for granted. The few farm workers who took the initiative to try and improve their situation found themselves blacklisted and unable to continue to earn a living in agriculture. Oregon farm workers today are striving hard to achieve the goals that have been fundamental directives of the trade union movement for well over 100 years. Decent wages, tolerable working conditions, and the thought that one's future would be brighter as a result of a hard day's work. The most significant barrier which stands between farm workers and the attainment of these goals is the lack of collective bargaining rights. farm workers have no established mechanism to designate or elect a labor organization as their bargaining agent, no authority to obligate growers to recognize a union, which workers choose, and to bargain in good faith, and no remedy when growers retaliate against organizing activities. Passage of this measure will put democracy and equality into agricultural labor relations. Those who help put food on our table will thus be guaranteed an orderly and a peaceful means by which they may improve their conditions of work. We ask the Oregon Legislature for its favorable action on Senate Bill 553. I'll be pleased to answer any questions.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference, which is the public policy office of the Archdiocese of Portland and the Diocese of Baker. It gives me great pleasure to be able to represent the Oregon Catholic Conference today in testifying in support of Senate Bill 553. By so doing, I participate in a church social teaching tradition going back to 1891 and Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, which is looked upon as the beginning of the modern era of church social teaching. And within that encyclical, Pope Leo XIII spoke of the right of workers to organize. And most recently, in 1986, the U.S. Catholic bishops, in their pastoral letter on the economy, specifically showed their compassionate concern both for farmers facing the loss of their lands and farm workers and their rights to organize. And I'd specifically like to read a couple of sentences from the economic pastoral, which speaks to the right of farm workers. Speaking about farm workers, the pastoral says, "Moreover, they are not as well protected by law and public policy as other groups of workers, and their efforts to organize and bargain collectively have been systematically and vehemently resisted, usually by farmers themselves. Migratory field workers are particularly susceptible to exploitation. This is reflected not only in their characteristically low wages, but also in the low standards of housing, health care, and education made available to these workers and their families." And in their policy recommendations, the bishops say, "Farmers also must end their opposition to farm worker unionization efforts. Farm workers have a legitimate right to belong to unions of their choice and to bargain collectively for just wages and working conditions. In pursuing that right, they are protecting the value of labor in agriculture, a protection that also applies to farmers who devote their own labor to their farm operations." Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the world is changing, and a reference to a law that I have not heard in this hearing so far is to the Immigration Reform and Control Act, recently enacted in the last couple of years by Congress. The people who are the seasonal agricultural workers will have a right after a number of years to become U.S. citizens. To the extent that they are allowed to avail themselves of the protection of our laws to enable themselves to have decent working conditions and decent wages, they potentially enable themselves and their families to have healthy, happy, economically productive lives that they will then share as U.S. citizens. So I think